This show is brought to you by 13 Turns, a new horror anthology by Kevin Carr. 13 jolting tales of terror, murder, and the macabre. Only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about the new films Finding Dory, Central Intelligence, Clown, The Witness, and D-Pad. I'll also be talking about some news, the trailer park, box office predictions, and of course the home cinema roundup. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
This is entertainment news. This is what makes this show unique. I am not going to talk about what everybody else is talking about. Why? Because if you want to hear that, you can go to any other station on the dial. I'm talking about entertainment news. That doesn't mean I don't have opinion about certain matters that are happening elsewhere outside of the world of entertainment, but that's not my bag. And I'm giving you guys a relief, a little bit of a break from this. If you want that discussion, go to Facebook. There's plenty of people arguing about it there. But right now, I'm just going to be talking about the news that's important to cinema and movies and blockbusters, the stuff that you go to escape. And speaking of escape, I got to give a big shout out to good friend Red State Gabe, who went to a triple feature this weekend. He was telling me about it in an email that I actually had suggested a few weeks back. He went and saw Batman vs. Superman, then went and saw Captain America Civil War, and then went and saw X-Men Apocalypse, all in the same day, all in the same building, which is a historic event because you have Superman, Batman, Wonder Woman, Aquaman, Iron Man, Captain America, Black Widow, Spider-Man, X-Men, Wolverine, everybody, all these characters are on the big screen for the first time ever in sort of like the same building, which is kind of amazing. So big shout out to Red State Gabe. He said it was great. It was an experience. And it does kind of give you that general view of superhero films, sort of this mosaic look at what's going on. But let's talk about a couple other movie news, some development news that's happening. There's nothing really big in terms of hard movie news, but there are some interesting development pieces. First of all, Harrison Ford has come out and said that Indiana Jones is not going to die in the next Indiana Jones movie. And that's great. You know, I mean, I think it's interesting that that's where everybody stampeded towards with him bringing back another franchise. But what the heck does he know? I mean, this guy is as high as a kite when he's not actually acting. And maybe when he is acting, he's just that good of an actor. Have you ever seen him on interviews? I swear he looks like he's in Dazed and Confused. And he is dazed and confused. But that's cool. Who knows? I am hoping that this next Indiana Jones movie does pass the torch or pass the whip onto somebody else and somebody better than Shia LaBeouf. The next piece of news I want to talk about is Ocean's 8. That is the new movie, apparently a prequel. Not really a remake, but a remake of sorts, where it's bringing back the Ocean's team. But like Ghostbusters did, it is making the film with women. Now, the cast is Elizabeth Banks, and you've got Sandra Bullock, and you've got Cate Blanchett. Helena Bonham Carter's in it. You got Mindy Kaling in it. It's going to be directed by Gary Ross, and I imagine it's maybe possibly going to bring in Julia Roberts or Catherine Zeta-Jones, who were in the other Ocean's movies. I'm all for more movies. It's not like you can't remake Ocean's 11 because it's a remake in itself, but I just hate the idea of just sort of swap casting. I just think that that's lowbrowing so much. If you want to do a heist movie, but make it with women. Instead of making it a pale knockoff of the other gender and then getting a guy to direct it anyways. I think it just sort of reeks of sexism, trying not to be sexism. The next piece of news I want to hit on is one of my favorite movies of last year. In fact, my favorite movie of last year, Sicario, is getting a sequel, and that's great. And the news is that it's going to be a standalone film. And then they're planning on a third film, which I think is kind of bold, considering that Sicario wasn't exactly a massive moneymaker. I loved it and it topped my list. But that opinion was not shared ubiquitously among film critics. I think that's kind of neat that we're going to get some more Sicario movies. I liked that concept. And hopefully, if Denis Villeneuve keeps his vision through there, even in just a producer level, that's great. It was handing it off to somebody else. Like, if John Chu somehow ends up directing one of these movies, then I will stop liking them. But I think that it's kind of cool that they're going to be making more Sicario films. And hopefully they'll give something more for Emily Blunt to do, because she kind of just was the observer through the whole movie. The last piece of news is, following Universal NBC buying DreamWorks and all of its subsidiaries, they're going to be, quote, resurrecting the Shrek franchise. What that means, I have no idea. But they're bringing it back. And for the reasons that it made almost $4 billion worldwide. And the first two movies were quite clever and cute. Then these sort of fractured fairy tale jokes got old. I don't know if they're going to bring back Mike Myers. I mean, that guy hasn't done a starring role in a while. And I don't know if he wants to be digging back in that hole again. I mean, even if they're talking about wanting to do a Austin Powers 4, which has been rumored for a decade. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. Two movies I want to talk about, both of them coming out in October-November timeframe. One is probably going to be a pretty big hit. One, we don't know yet. The latter is Jack Reacher, Never Go Back, opens on October 21st.
One guy took them all down with his bare hands.
Purple Heart, Silver Star, you're a legend.
Folks wonder why you left.
I woke up one morning and the uniform didn't fit.
Jack Reacher for Major Turner.
Major Turner's been arrested.
On what charge?
Espionage.
He's been set up.
Reacher? He's here to kill you.
This came from a quick sneak peek that was on Entertainment Tonight earlier this week. Of course, bringing back Tom Cruise as Jack Reacher, and he's paired up with Colby Smulders. Even watching these clips in this trailer, I still have a problem with the casting. I've never read a single Jack Reacher book, or I've never even read a page from a Jack Reacher book. But the problem is they present Tom Cruise as the character that Jack Reacher is, who is supposed to be in the book, this massive, strapping guy who could, like, literally kick down a door. And you look at Tom Cruise, and you're like, well, maybe you could kick over a wedding cake. There's a line from the first Jack Reacher, and I said this on the show back then when it came out, back in 2013 or whatever. There's a line where somebody identifies him by saying, "Is there a guy here who looks like he can kill a man with one punch?" I'll tell you, if somebody put a lineup of celebrities, including Tom Cruise, I might pick Pauly Shore before I pick Tom Cruise as a celebrity who could kill somebody with one punch. He is just not that. And they're still kind of just saying, well, if we write him that way, people will accept it. Just make him Ethan Hunt with a different name. You know, compromise on the image of Jack Reacher a bit for the image of Tom Cruise, because they don't mix. You'd have a better shot with Tyler Perry, you know, when he was doing Alex Cross, because at least he's a big guy. But who knows? It looks like it'll be a fun movie. Just ridiculous from the casting perspective still. The next movie I want to talk about from the trailer park is Mona. Not about the James Taylor song about a pig. It opens on November 23rd.
Do you know who Maui is? Only the greatest demigod in all the Pacific Islands. With his magical fishhook, he slowed down the sun, pulled islands out of the sea, battled monsters. And I should know, because I'm Maui. Hey! Ah-hoo! Nothing? Really? What's a demigod gotta do?
That is, of course, the voice of Dwayne Johnson, The Rock, as a demigod in the Hawaiian Islands. I've been to Hawaii, and this is going to be great. My wife and I are going to want to watch it because we've been to Hawaii for our honeymoon. We went there 2 years later. Haven't been there since, but it's just such a gorgeous place, and it'll be vicariously living Hawaii style through Disney animation. It's just a teaser, so we don't have any idea of the characters or what's actually happening in the story. We'll get a little more of that later, but, you know, hey, good company with Zootopia, Frozen, and Big Hero 6, and of course, stuff like Wreck-It Ralph as well. That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Central Intelligence and D-Pan. Kevin Carr's new horror anthology, 13 Turns, brings you a series of stories inspired by H.P. Lovecraft, Stephen King, The Twilight Zone, and classic gothic horror. A man is trapped, forced to murder himself every day of his unnatural life. Necromancers resurrect two famous figures from history for sport. A beautiful day in an amusement park turns into a murder investigation after a mysterious death on a roller coaster. A researcher in an abandoned prison discovers a portal to another dimension. 13 Turns by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store, and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Kevin Carr with Fat Guys at the Movies coming back and starting up with the movie reviews. The first one I want to talk about is Central Intelligence. Kevin Hart plays a high school superstar who now has a humdrum life, while Dwayne Johnson plays a CIA agent who was bullied in high school.
You should know one thing about me. I'm in the CIA. 3 weeks ago, an enemy of the state stole the encryption keys to the entire U.S. spy satellite program.
I need your super sweet accounting skills to help me figure out the last piece of this puzzle.
You were the coolest guy in school.
You're my only friend, Calvin. You're the only one in this whole world that I trust.
You chose to be an international CIA spy.
Because I don't like bullies.
You were like Jason Bourne in Jorts.
I kind of like Kevin Hart. There's nothing wrong with that. Kevin Hart's a funny guy. I've even seen some of his stand-up specials. They're not exactly directed at me, personally. But they're fun. And in general, I like him in the movies. And he is box office gold. Now, that doesn't mean everything he's done is great. He's been in some crappy films. But he's also been in some good stuff. I mean, like, Ride Along is a great example of a movie that was exactly what it needed to be, and it completely connected with an audience. And the critics panned it, as they did Ride Along 2. I kind of liked both those movies. Central Intelligence, part of what makes this movie work is the Mutt and Jeff pairing up of Kevin Hart and Dwayne Johnson. And even they have the joke in the trailer. If you ever see either the trailer say it, I think, and some of the standees in the theater say it, that for a good comedy, you just need a little Hart and a big Johnson. That's exactly the kind of humor it's going at. It's lowbrow, and it is unashamedly so. And there's nothing wrong with lowbrow. And another critic friend of mine had mentioned to me after the screening, he said, that's a real male movie. Because, of course, Dwayne Johnson's character was fat in high school. And, of course, then he bulked up. But he's still a big, goofy nerd. He loves unicorns. And he's kind of a goofball. His favorite movie, 16 Candles, in the film. So it's just, he's very unlike the image of Dwayne Johnson. He's not at all the image that Dwayne Johnson has in, say, the Fast and Furious movies. More of the character he was in Be Cool, which was the follow-up to Get Shorty. I think Dwayne Johnson actually has an incredible talent for comedy. And he doesn't get to utilize it all that much. He did for a while in doing certain movies like The Game Plan, where he adopted the little girl or found out it was his daughter. And you see him in those Kindergarten Cop roles, and it works for him. I think, like Arnold Schwarzenegger, he has a real knack for that kind of a comedy. And while this is different, this isn't a family comedy. It's more of a screwball buddy cop film. He works. And what's neat about the movie is they play with convention. They do a bit of a role reversal. In almost every movie you see Kevin Hart in, he plays the crazy man. He plays the goofball. He plays the Costello to everybody else's Abbott. Best example would be Ride Along. Ice Cube is, in fact, the straight man in that movie. He is always looking cool. He's always given a glare. And it's Kevin Hart who has to act wacky and crazy. Well, they do the opposite in this movie. Kevin Hart is actually the straight man in this movie. And it's a bit of a nuanced use of his comedy. And I mean, this is me overanalyzing it a bit, but it's a bit nuanced of his talent because he's able to do what he does as a comedian, getting big and being crazy. But it's all reactionary stuff. It's all to the absurdity of Dwayne Johnson's comedy side. He's clearly the one that gets all the funny moments, but Kevin Hart is able to spin those. And that actually is great, because if you go back and you look historically, comedic duos, the most revered one by the industry is not the funny guy, it's the straight man. In fact, part of the great schism between Bud Abbott and Lou Costello back in the 40s was that Bud Abbott was paid more than Lou Costello because Bud Abbott was such a great straight man, and he had inherited Costello from something else. He'd done straight man bits in vaudeville back in the day, and that made him sort of a coveted character. And that's kind of part of the reason why Lou Costello had such a grudge against him, was because he was paid more, even though everyone in the audience always kind of liked Lou Costello better. But to make the guy funny, you got to have a good straight man. And I think Kevin Hart did a great job as a straight man. I don't think anyone's going to give him that credit for this movie, but it's also just funny. Is it absurdly written? Is it stupid? Yeah. Does it completely make sense? Not at all. There's a lot of disbelief you have to suspend to make this work. But both Kevin Hart and Dwayne Johnson have a real charisma on screen, and they got really good chemistry together, considering how wildly, absurdly disproportionate size they are to each other. It had me laughing, and partly because I wasn't expecting anything more than what it was. So, yeah, I like Central Intelligence. I'm going to give this one a rock. So, you know, the heck with the rest of the critics. I know it's going to have like a 3% of Rotten Tomatoes by the end of the weekend, but that's okay.
It rocks.
Excellent.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's move on to their next film, which is Deepan. There's no trailer for this because it's Sri Lankan and French. There's very little English in it at all. But the film is about a military leader from Sri Lanka who assumes the identity of a nobody to immigrate to France as he tries to escape the conflict that he's been involved in. Now, this won the Palme d'Or at the Cannes Film Festival back in 2015. So it's something that has a certain amount of notoriety to it beyond just it being some foreign film that's hitting theaters. And it's been kind of working its way around the country. It has about three different movies working together with these characters. And when a movie has multiple, it's trying to be multiple things, that's oftentimes a bad thing for a movie. And you've even heard me say this. I'm like, well, I couldn't decide whether it's trying to do this or do that. This movie actually was pretty expertly crafted that all three of these kind of disparate things kind of work together. On one hand, it's a story of these three people who've had the rest of their family die, get together and pretend to be this family who's died and just assume their identity so they can move to another country and get the heck out of Sri Lanka. So it's just this story of this non-family trying to fit together and how they're not really the parents of this 9 or 10 year old girl they have, who looks like she's probably like about 11 or 12. And they're trying to pretend to be her parents, but even though they've not raised her, they've only known her for a couple weeks, and how the couple, the man and the woman, how they don't even really know each other, and they're not in love, and but it's not even an arranged marriage. It's just it's a false marriage. So it's this sort of family drama of immigrants trying to struggle to work and live in France. At the same time, it's a bit of a tension movie because you know they've got this history, and you know at some point somebody's going to freak out. Either one of the people are going to leave, or they live in a crappy area of France that's dangerous and full of gang activity. And you're, oh, somebody's going to get involved in that, or it's going to come blowing back on them because he's a caretaker there trying to live under the radar. And then, of course, there's this war, that conflict that's still going on that destroyed his family and their family. And he was part of the atrocities that were being done, but he's trying to escape it. And that is, of course, looming behind him and with the constant fear that he's going to be found out. Now, the whole movie doesn't come together as well at the end. It gets a little silly at the end, in my opinion. But overall, it's an interesting movie. And I said this last week about Rabin, The Last Day, is it gives a worldview of this because it's not told from an American perspective. It doesn't involve America at all. There's not even talk of America. It's not even involved in this conflict. So it gives a really interesting world perspective because it doesn't have an American perspective at all. Again, it's world cinema. It's not for everybody. It's subtitled. If you have the opinion that if you wanted to read, you'd read a book, even though you don't go see this movie. But it's an interesting movie to check out. I'm going to say it kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Finding Dory and Clown.
Open Gangnam Style.
Take a seasonal trip to the zombie apocalypse. Kevin Carr's new novelettes, Not the End and Gobble, offer a new take on the zombie nightmare.
In Not the End, a man wakes up from a coma to find a viral outbreak has sent the world on the defensive. He must escape and learn the true nature of the zombies. The story Gobble takes the readers back to the beginning of the outbreak, which erupts at a tense Thanksgiving dinner. Not the End and Gobble by Kevin Carr are available now. Only 99 cents in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited.
I'm too sexy for my shirt. Too sexy for my shirt. So sexy it hurts.
Back, guys, at the movies with Kevin Carr, rolling into another great segment of movie reviews. Let's talk about Finding Dory. In this Pixar sequel, Marlin and his son Nemo travel across the ocean to find their friend Dory, who is looking for her parents.
Migration is about going home, which is where you're from.
How do the stingrays all know where to go?
Instinct. Something deep inside you that feels so familiar that you have to listen to it.
My mom, my dad, I have a family.
We will never forget you, Dory.
What if I forget you?
I miss them. You know what that feels like?
Yes.
Then we better get going. Grab your things.
I was originally somewhat skeptical when I heard that Pixar was digging up these previous hits and making sequels to them. Now, I like Cars 2, and Cars 2 I kind of put outside of this because Cars 2 feels much more like an intended sequel. You know, same thing with Toy Story 2. Toy Story 2 came out so soon, relatively, especially that time because it took years to make these movies. Toy Story 2 came out so soon after Toy Story 1 that it didn't seem odd that it was a sequel. What started to worry me was when they started to announce they were doing Monsters University. And I like Monsters University. I thought it was fine. It was not nearly as good as Monsters, Inc., but it was still fun. And then, of course, they mentioned Finding Dory. And I'm like, Finding Dory? What's coming out in 2016? That's like, what, over 10 years since Finding Nemo was originally released. And as much as I can support a sequel that comes many years after the film, because sometimes they're good. Sometimes they're really good, like Alien, which had the sequel Aliens come out 7 years later. Or it's something that was a little bit nervous and actually turned out to be a good movie, like Psycho 2 was actually a pretty good movie. Not the following ones, but Psycho 2, the original sequel to that, which came out in, sometime in the 80s? So you're talking 20-some years after the first film came out? So I can appreciate this actually working. And even a movie like The Two Jakes, which was a long past overdue sequel to Chinatown, and nobody got because nobody remembered Chinatown when they went to go see it, and it just hinged so much on what actually happened in that movie. So Finding Dory, I was a little bit skeptical of because I'm like, wasn't Finding Nemo a complete story? And originally what's funny is Finding Nemo, I was not a big fan when it first came out. When I first saw it, I was like, eh, it's okay. And people loved it. I mean, it made massive amounts of money and I found myself in the minority. What ended up turning me on to the movie was getting it on DVD, and my son was like 3 or 4 when it came out. And when you've got a kid that young, especially if it's your first child, you tend to watch whatever he wants to watch. You put a movie on loop. You know, by the time, you know, I have a third son who's now 8. By the time he's born, I'm like, yeah, you can go watch that in your room. I'm not going to have that nonsense going. I can't watch any more Oswald. It's going to kill me. So I would watch a lot of the movies that he wanted to watch. And this one was one of them he wanted to watch over and over and over again when we got it on DVD. And I found the rewatchability was amazing. It did not get on my nerves the way a lot of films did, like The Lion King, just I couldn't take after so many watches. And even Harry Potter. He watched Harry Potter all the time because he loved the music of all things. But Finding Nemo, I thought, had a really good rewatchability. And it's kind of grown on me. And I now like the movie quite a bit. So Finding Dory had a lot to live up to. And Andrew Stanton's coming off of John Carter of Mars, which was a big kind of kick in the teeth for him. And even when Finding Dory then started, I was a little nervous because as I'm watching it, I'm like, this looks like it's just completely rehashing Finding Nemo. Only instead of trying to find an orange fish, they're trying to find a blue fish. But it does deviate from that at a certain point. You got to get about a half hour into the movie before it really kind of becomes its own film. And once that happens, it really grew on me, partly because it's for lack of a better term, even though they don't really, but they get them out of the water. They get them out of the ocean. They track her down to this marine hospital. So they're kind of going around inside tanks and stuff. And it's great because they're also not trying to push a message either. Because one of the things, when I saw them doing this, I'm like, oh no, we're going to get a Blackfish message. We're going to get an anti-SeaWorld, you know, let the whales be free. And I'm like, that's fine. You want to have that message. That's great. They had a whole movie out of it called Blackfish. It's a good movie. Go check it out. But I don't want to see that in my kids' movies. I don't want to see that in my Disney Pixar movies. So they avoid that really, really quite well. And while they have callbacks to characters and jokes, like there's a scene with seagulls flying over, and of course they're yelling, mine, mine, mine. They're not relying on all the same jokes. They have some unique ones. And you see these in the trailer too. But they have some interesting character. My favorite character is the seven tentacled octopus. And it's a lot of fun. The movie's very charming. It's not as long. It's a little bit of a shorter film. I took my 8-year-old and he loved it. It's hard for me to compare it to Finding Nemo because I've had such a long experience in my varying degrees of liking that movie. But I can just authentically say I enjoyed this one. I immediately enjoyed this one as opposed to Nemo, which took a little bit of time to grow on me. But I thought it was cute. It's great for kids. It's great for families. It is going to be the next feather in the cap of Disney this year. Disney's having a banner year. This is going to be like the fourth massive hit after Zootopia, Jungle Book, and Captain America. I mean, yeah, you had Alice in the Looking Glass didn't do very well, but they don't care because this movie's going to make up for all of that. So yeah, I'm going to say Finding Dory rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Since I was talking marginally about Clownfish in the last movie, let's talk about Clown, which is not a movie you want to take kids to. It is a horror film. It is produced by Eli Roth, and it is the story of an average suburban man who dresses up as a clown for his son's birthday, only to discover the costume he used is from a skin of a demon, and he will turn into an evil clown himself. Charming.
He's gonna miss the clown.
There's a little bit of goof up.
There's no clown coming.
Who double books a clown?
I thought you had a backup.
Everything's gonna be fine.
Mr. Clown?
I physically cannot get it off. It's suffocating.
Daddy?
Oh, Jack, sweetie, let's get you to bed.
That's not Daddy.
I can feel myself changing.
It's not a costume.
I love stories about evil clowns. I have a real thing for evil clowns. I remember reading It when I was in college, and it was a great book. And what's funny about It is the look of Tim Curry as Pennywise the Clown supersedes the TV movie of it. The TV movie of It isn't all that great, especially once they get to the adults. But Tim Curry looks so good, and he's so iconic in that role that people remember him far more than they remember the movie It, the four-night miniseries that was on in, 1990 or so. So I love the evil clown idea. I went to a haunted house last year. My son, my oldest son, has a bit of clown phobia, and I forced him to go into this haunted house with evil clowns. It was a lot of fun to watch him. So the idea of having a real clown is awesome. I love the idea of a real clown, and that's like Killer Clowns from Outer Space is such a great horror movie, but whimsically so, because it's about real clowns. That's the creatures they are. This movie plays off of that, and it does play off the ancient demons. It has a bit of, you know, its foot in the grave along with like Sinister and that sort of these evil demons that can take people over, and maybe they have a benign look, like Krampus has that benign appearance of a Christmas movie. With all that said, and as creepy as the clown ends up becoming in the movie, it's just okay. It's fine for like just an independent film. And it got most notoriety because it was an evil clown, but it could have been a lot better. It could have been a lot grislier, and it really could have been violent and disturbing. And it's not. It's just kind of turns into kind of just a modern monster movie when it could really, really have pushed the envelope and become very notorious. And right now, the thing, biggest thing it has going for it is the fact that it's about an evil clown. So it's worth seeing for that. But it could have really superseded its own self and superseded the genre and could have given us the next iconic horror character, but it didn't. What's nice, though, is you can always do Clown 2, and I would love this movie to get a little bit of notoriety and then a really grisly, good, independent director, something like a Ty West, to take this and really do something with it. I'm going to say it kind of rocks just because it's a clown movie. The clown wins some points. So it kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
That's it for the segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be reviewing The Witness, talk about the box office, and of course, the home cinema roundup. There's something in the woods, something worth killing for. In Kevin Carr's new thriller, Underbrush, four budding scientists work together to discover a secret hidden in the mysterious Kaikman Woods. This dangerous chain of events is kicked off when a student disappears in the woods near a small college. Four graduate students are brought into an abandoned area of the forest for a secretive biological study, which is nothing more than a cover to look into the truth behind the disappearance. Underbrush by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Kevin Carr with Fat Guys at the Movies, finishing up the movie reviews. We've got one more to do. It's a smaller movie, and it's been in release for just a couple weeks. I've mentioned this before, but this is worth knowing for those of you out there, because I know this is heard in many cities around this great country and in Guam. This is how movie releases work. Big movies, like this week, it's Finding Dory and Central Intelligence. Those are the big ones. Those are going wide and like 3,000 screens. And those are the ones you're going to hear the most about. Now, a lot of the smaller stuff I talk about are these rock and roll releases where they go from city to city to city. And just because if you pick up a copy of like the New York Times or you go to Variety or you go to the Hollywood Reporter, they're going to be covering stuff and things like opening this weekend and it's only opening in New York and LA. Well, for those of you in Billings, Montana or Greeley, Colorado, you're not in New York and LA. So you may not get a chance to see these movies. I cover them when they kind of make it to my town, because that's usually when I get a chance to see them. And I usually get them a little bit earlier in the cycle now that we've got a really good independent theater in town that plays a lot of stuff. That's the Gateway Film Center in downtown Columbus, or just north of downtown in the campus area of The Ohio State University. But there's a lot of them that are available also on demand. So if you hear me talking about one of these films like Clown, I would not be surprised if you could find Clown, at least maybe not this week, but within the next couple weeks in an on-demand platform. These films are often available in multiple outlets. So if you're lucky enough to have it at a theater that does not have people who talk and text in it, go check it out in the theater. But a lot of these films you can catch online in very legitimate outfits. And, you know, you only have to pay essentially a ticket price to see them at home. And that's great because you're supporting actual independent film and smaller film, which really needs it. You know, Dory is going to be making millions and $100 million or more this weekend. And there's no flies on Disney for that. But Disney doesn't need your money, but, you know, the guys who made Clown need your money. The people who made Deep Pan need your money. The people who made The Witness need your money if you're going to watch the movie. The Witness is one of those movies, I think it actually technically opened a week or two ago. 50 years after the infamous murder of Kitty Genovese, her brother William digs into the legend to find out the truth behind it.
I was 16 when my sister Kitty was murdered in New York City. For years, I avoided the details of that night, but it's worse not knowing the truth. The Times story was seen as proof that New York City was uncaring, and my sister's been the symbol of bystander apathy for decades.
It's a fascinating story,
and undoubtedly sold newspapers.
I'm sick of listening to people tell you 38 people stood by and watched. That's not so.
For those of you who don't know who Kitty Genovese was, she was a woman who was killed in New York in 1964, and the story goes that 38 of her neighbors in the little community were looking out and could see her get attacked, and then like a half hour later, the guy came back and he raped her and he stabbed her, and she's lying there bleeding and dying and screaming for help, and nobody did a thing. And it kind of became this notoriety. It actually was partly responsible for 911 being adopted in this country, because it was a great way for people to anonymously call in to the police if something bad was happening. And her brother, Bill, who has been carrying this with him for 15 years because he was a young kid when she was killed, this has impacted his life. And it was a rallying cry for the apathetic public that doesn't care, the people who didn't want to get involved. And he digs into this. And it's fascinating because you get a real in-depth personal look at not Kitty as much. You do. You get a look at her personal life. But see, he never really knew her after this incident because nobody would talk about it in the family. It was taboo. It was verboten for them to really talk about it. So, and they even talked to her nieces and nephews and people who were younger in the family who were born after this event. And they're like, yeah, I didn't know anything about my aunt. I just knew how she died. Everyone knew how she died. And it's such a horrifying story. And the uplifting part is there's stuff in there that's not accurate. And there's stuff in there that is the horrible story that when you look at how Bill Genovese reconstructs what happened and goes to the court documents and he finds out that people aren't as horrible as you are led to believe with this story. And that makes you feel better because while there are terrible people in this world, namely the guy who killed her, the rest of the average population is not that cold. And when you actually look at it, you'd be like, okay, I can see how this would have happened, how the story could have been constructed this way. But really, what were the people to do? You know, they heard her, they looked down there, and then she went around a corner, and then they heard nothing more. They didn't know what happened. And maybe they did call the police, maybe they didn't. And then sort of there's a sketchy record of what actually happened that night, even from the authorities, because you're talking about 1964. This is before computer system and any sort of automated logging of calls. It was all written in pencil in a book. So this is a really good movie to see, especially if you've been personally impacted emotionally by just hearing this story. Now, the movie, like any sort of documentary, especially any documentary about something so personal and horrible that has no closure, like the senseless murder of somebody, there is no closure to this. There is no answers. At some point, this happened. His sister was killed. And it's a horrible thing, but there really wasn't a reason. And you can blame somebody, but that doesn't make you feel any better. And there is no closure to this. And that's kind of part of the weakness of the movie is that as it gets to the end, the movie has to end and it has to have some sort of ending. And the ending in the last 15 minutes are like, well, a little bit weird and goofy and doesn't quite work. But I understand why, because at some point you have to close the book and step away. And I think this movie gives Bill Genovese the strength and the ability to close that book. The Witness kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the box office. Last week I said The Conjuring was going to get $30 million. It did $40 million. It did really well. Almost as well as its predecessor, which is odd for this summer, considering Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles and Snow White and the Huntsman and Alice Through the Looking Glass and even X-Men Apocalypse all came in substantially under their predecessors. And one of the things I was reading online, they were talking about how it really didn't have much social media presence. And Deadline Hollywood's flabbergasted that this movie did so well when nobody was really buzzing about it online. And I'm like, well, that's just because people wanted to see it who weren't vomiting out every thought that they had in their head. And that's good because this is not the kind of movie where you want to be in an audience of people vomiting out every thought that they had in their head. Warcraft did $24 million, which is pretty miserable. That's like Battleship and John Carter numbers. Now, what I find interesting is the industry, just as much as the industry, was painting a near $900 million box office for Batman vs. Superman as an abject failure because people were so mad that they didn't like that movie, they wanted to fail. Yet you look at a movie like Warcraft that spent, what is it, like $180 million? And it made $24. Now they're like, oh, but it's doing so well overseas. And yeah, that happens. And you can do that. It's made 10 times overseas what it has made in the U.S. That's a good success for it. And that's sort of like Terminator Genesis, but you can hardly say it's a massive hit. It just happened to be a massive hit overseas. Who knows what'll happen if they make a sequel? Will they even make a sequel? And I think it's going to sink like a stone. Even Terminator Genesis couldn't make it to $100 million. I'm going to be shocked if this movie can make it to $60 million. It's a bomb. It just may be saved by China numbers. And then, of course, Now You See Me 2 came in third. That's kind of a disappointing number. I don't think it's going to have the legs that the first film did, and that's what made that first film a hit. Now, this weekend, Finding Dory is the easy pick. It's well over $100 million for the weekend. I'm thinking around $110 million. I think that's a good conservative note. I think it might go even higher. And then on top of it, you got Central Intelligence coming out. I think this is going to be a monster weekend because these two movies, I think, are going to play very well in their demographics. And Central Intelligence, look for like a $40 million. Look for ride-along numbers for Central Intelligence because it's got The Rock, it's got Kevin Hart, and it's a funny movie, and I think it's a crowd pleaser. And after having a weekend like last weekend, you got to kind of like go all the way back well into maybe when Captain America and Jungle Book were doing well for there to be those bona fide massive hits outside of course, The Conjuring 2. So I think both Finding Dory and Central Intelligence are going to have great weekends. Like I said, between the two of them, it's going to be over $150 million. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. Some fun movies this week. London Has Fallen, as ridiculous as that is and how over-the-top violent it is. It's like an old canon movie starring Chuck Norris, something like Invasion USA. 10 Cloverfield Lane, a great little Twilight Zone episode. The Young Messiah, a fictional story of the young Jesus before he became the Jesus we all knew. Eddie the Eagle, a charming little story about a ski jumper from England. And then The X-Files, that event series that they did, is available on Blu-ray and DVD, as is Star Trek, the original series, new Blu-ray box set for the entire series. That's it for this week. I need to go, and next week I'm going to be talking about Independence Day Insurgents, The Shallows, and The Free State of Jones. Until then, have a fat time at the movies.